Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and is even more exciting than watching Sky try to get 4 hours of live telly out of one loan move to West Brom on transfer deadline day. I'm Kevin Day, and turning down a free transfer to Swiss Ramble is Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, a predictably quiet transfer window, I guess?
Yes, if you've got no money, you can't spend it. And that's the position of football at present. Also, the players don't want to move because nobody can offer them pay rises. So it's a very sticky wicket indeed.
Yeah, my mother never lived by that principle. If you've got no money, you can't spend it. God love her.
Mine too.
Yeah. Maybe something to do with where they're from, Kieran. Who knows? Later in this episode, we'll hear from Parag Murate, the president of 49ers Enterprises, which is the commercial arm of the San Francisco 49ers. He spoke to us about, cricket. And his investment in Leeds United, which was recently increased to 37%. It was a very positive and upbeat chat, Kieran, wasn't it?
Yes. I think Leeds fans are going to be excited from what they hear. I think he wants to retain what he refers to as the nuts and bolts, the boots of Leeds United, while still trying to move the club on. So a few interesting revelations to look forward to.
Yeah, sadly, positive and upbeat are not words we can use about our first story. And you did say, Kieran, that you thought South Yorkshire may overtake the East Midlands as an area of concern. And lo and behold, several Sheffield Wednesday players haven't been paid their full wages this month.
Yes, I mean, there's good news for Sheffield Wednesday on the pitch. They don't have a manager, they don't have a director of football, they don't appear to have a chief executive, but that's not stopping them from winning matches, which perhaps calls into question some of the processes that you do see at clubs. So congratulations to Sheffield Wednesday on the pitch. Off the pitch, it appears, according to one of the stories in the local press, that if the players were on more than £7,000 a month, they were being capped at that level. And if they were below it, they were being paid in full. Now, Sheffield Wednesday haven't published any accounts since 2018, which reminds me of another club in the Championship. Mm. They're now more than 6 months overdue. It's the second year on the trot that's arisen. So that means they're going to pay a fine of £3,000, which in the wider scheme of things isn't a cause for concern. The fact that they're not willing to tell the fans, fans are the biggest investors in a club, what's going on, I don't think is great. The average salary in their most recent accounts, which was 2018, was £27,000 a month. Mm-hmm. So if they're capping people at over seven, you can see a fair number of players being perhaps a bit cheesed off. Though again, I'd stress it doesn't seem to be reflected on what's happening in the pitch.
It does seem a bit odd, the fact that you're necessarily alienating your better paid, and therefore you imagine better players.
Yes, I mean, I guess sort of the mentality of a dressing room does tend to be quite collegiate, all for one and one for all. And ultimately, when you go out and you're playing on the football pitch, all the sort of the internal bitching and unhappiness with regards to the management and sort of the structure of the club, which might be bothering players, can sometimes just disappear. I've heard footballers say historically that the only place that they ever felt free was in the 90 minutes, on a weekly basis or twice weekly basis when they were playing football. And once they got off the pitch, that's when all the problems used to start. So this could be evidence of that.
And why is it, Kieran, we only tend to hear of players not getting paid their wages rather than management team, training team, etc.? Is that because it's not happening or because that's not as good a story?
I think there's an element of both. Normally, the chief executive will call in and say something to the manager or the coaching team, because there's only one or two of them. And also remember, the manager quite often has to have meetings with the board. You know, he'll normally attend a monthly meeting with regards to progress on and off the pitch, what's the budget for the next transfer window and things of that nature. Whereas the players won't necessarily have that closer relationship with things at board level.
Oh, sorry, I'm just sitting here speculating who was on the phone. And I'm going to go an angry Mel Morris.
Disappointed that his club's not getting mentioned anymore.
So far. No, I've had a look, actually. I don't think they will get mentioned today. National League clubs, Kieran, across all three divisions were offered the chance to decide what happens to the rest of the season this week. What was decided?
There's going to be a full vote on the 6th of February. National League North and South they're having a 2-week suspension. There's a lot of confusion. You know, we've covered the National League story in terms of, initially as part of the winter support package from the government, the National League teams were given a grant, and that was great. And then they all fell out in terms of the way that the grant was going to be distributed. There's now a further £11 million being made available to the National League teams. But it turns out that the government is of the opinion that this money is in the form of a loan, albeit over 20 years and at very low interest rates. The teams, or the National League, were under the impression that it was going to be a grant. And they've rightly pointed out is that if they politely decline the loan because clubs are concerned that they can't repay it, it's going to cost £14 million to put the players on furlough. So surely it's in the taxpayers' best interest to fund the continuation of the season in the form of a grant. But what we are now seeing is people acting in self-interest. So those clubs towards the top of the National League, one of the votes will be, let's take the loan and continue the season, whereas the alternative is, let's just go into furlough. So yeah, that those are quite extreme views. If those clubs towards the top of the National League, it's in their interest to continue, because if you get promoted to the EFL, all of a sudden you're getting solidarity payments from the Premier League, you're getting the EFL TV deal on top of that. You know, that's worth £1.5 million a year potentially. So those clubs, you know, the likes of Notts County and so on, you can understand their viewpoint. The clubs in National League North and South, they're sort of slightly compromised in the sense that whatever decision is made has to have a 75% majority, and every club in the National League gets a single vote, but the National League North and National League South only get two votes between them. So where they're going to go is they're not so certain themselves. So it's looking messy. I have been talking to somebody connected with one of the National League South clubs who is of the opinion that it's going to become very political, and it's going to be a game of poker played when this vote takes place, and it's due to take place on the 6th of Feb.
So we'll be able to bring more news when we meet again next Monday then, presumably. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. Apologies, Kieran, if you heard a slight yelp at the start of that answer. We're recording this at about 4:30 on Wednesday, which I thought was just late enough to bring a glass of wine out with me. But the look on Ali's face when I opened the fridge door indicated that she didn't agree. So I brought a cup of tea out with me and took a big gulp, and it's still really hot. I worry, Kieran, this is why we're not winning the BAFTAs. It's because they think you're brilliant. They think, yeah, Kieran's great, but the other bloke, he just can't hold his drink. He gets so distracted by hot drinks and stuff. You wouldn't know this, Kieran, because you never touch alcohol or hot liquid, which is probably...
I do have my water bottle by my side, as always. That's about as far as it goes.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't tell you this, but I went to visit my dad this morning, God love him, who's 86, who's been doing some decorating. He's got the flat looking lovely, but he went, I've filled the fireplace with semen.
I was like, what?
He's got these little models of sailors that he was given.
Right.
And it's just, And obviously, it's like, well, well done, Dad, 86. That's very good. And then he caught himself when he went, ah, it's been a long time since I've been out of affiliate. But there you go. Thank you. This is another reason why we're not winning the BAFTA, isn't it? too easily distracted by smart. Now, still in the National League, Wrexham AFC, it transpires, were the only National League club to be excluded from the emergency funding package. Was that because of the Hollywood money?
No, this does seem very harsh on Wrexham AFC. It was determined that because they are physically located in Wales, and despite the fact that the National League is an English competition, that they were not entitled to a share out from, really? From the upcoming deal. And therefore, to be fair to the club, they've abstained from voting. And Rob McElhenney cheerfully tweeted, well, effectively, bollocks to you lot. We don't need the money, because he and his partner are going to be in a position to perhaps make up for that. But it does seem very harsh at a time when the government does seem keen to promote the union, for want of a better phrase, that it's excluding clubs who are physically located in Wales from central government payments.
But that makes no sense. I mean, surely Wrexham, much as we discourage people from taking legal action, but if Cardiff, Swansea and Newport aren't excluded from solidarity payments or government grant, why would a team in the National League be? That doesn't make sense. That seems grossly unfair.
It does on the face of it. I mean, there has been an equivalent of the winter support package from Holyrood affecting clubs in Scotland, and I think a few of the SPFL clubs are trying to apply for that and things of that nature. But it looks as if this particular responsibility has been devolved to the individual parts of the UK, and therefore it's up to the Welsh government and Scottish government to decide on distributions to individual clubs there. And one can only presume, and I must confess, I've not checked up, but I've not seen anything from the Welsh government with regards to a package which would impact upon Wrexham AFC.
Mm. And another club in the National League, Chesterfield, has furloughed some of its players.
Yeah, I feel quite uncomfortable about this. I mean, we talk about this word furlough, but it's actually formally called the job retention scheme. Now, what Chesterfield have done is that they've identified four players who, for whatever reason, the management thinks isn't going to get a game for the rest of this season. Now that happens at every club. Every season, you know, you and I can identify those players at both Palace and Brighton who we know they're in the squad somewhere, but yeah, you know, they've not even reached the bench for a League Cup game, and you know that they're turning up to training, picking up the money, and going home, and that is something which happens across all football clubs. It now appears that Chesterfield are effectively using the job retention scheme as a means for the taxpayer to pick up the tab. So the remainder of the players are being paid. But these players are being paid effectively by the taxpayer. My understanding is that under the job retention scheme, under the furlough scheme, the government picks up 80% of, I think, is it the first £2,500 per month. It looks as if the club is going to make up the remainder of their pay packets. But again, it's certainly, in my reaction, is that this goes against the principle of the scheme, if clearly it would appear to satisfy the individual wording of it. Chesterfield are claiming that other clubs are doing it too, but if they are, they're certainly going under the radar.
Yeah, I always feel sorry for the sort of player you talk about there. I mean, like Max Mayo was a classic example for Palace recently before we moved him on. A really exciting, potentially young footballer who came with great hopes, and through no fault of his own, simply because the manager didn't fancy him, found himself picking up the occasional League Cup game or whatever it was. And he's still criticised by people saying, oh, yeah, well, he's happy to sit out his contract and take the money and play with the under-23s. Well, he's quite clearly not. He wants to play first-team football. So I think the very least he can expect is to actually be paid while waiting for a manager to come in who does fancy him. But I did, like you say, there is something slightly uneasy about this situation. And if you don't know of any other clubs that are doing it, it would indicate that there aren't any other clubs doing it, basically. Is that right?
Well, yes, some clubs do keep their cards close to their chest. My view is if Chesterfield have got the evidence, I'd be naming names because at present it looks as if they're the only kids in town who are taking this approach.
Yeah, Kieran, if you can't find out by going to the company's house, then basically it's not happening. We've ascertained that in the past. There's nothing you can't find out at the company's house. And you may be able to find out about these next two stories. There's talk of takeovers. And I think we could probably have guessed this was going to happen because that's Sunderland are the sort of club where things never seem to run smoothly. But their prospective takeover has hit another snag.
Yes. Sunderland were due to be taken over by Kirill Louis Dreyfus, the 22-year-old French inheritance billionaire whose own family has historically owned clubs in France. And when this was first announced, I think Sunderland fans were relieved. The relationship with Stuart Donald has fallen down. Anybody that's watched Sunderland Till I Die on Netflix has been watching through the sort of their fingers as sort of the some of the farcical behaviour in the boardroom was revealed. But it turns out that whilst Kirill Louis Dreyfus is due to take a controlling stake in the club, so and controlling means more than 50%, it looks as if Stuart Donald was planning to keep 15%, and then into the equation comes One Satori. And One Satori is described as a Uruguayan politician and businessman. Now, you're in an industry, Kevin, in the world of entertainment where South American exports are popular, it's fair to say. So therefore, anybody who is a South American politician and businessman, you go, well, that seems a little bit strange. The story is that Mr. Satori bought his 20% of the club for £1. We're not sure whether that story is true or not, but he is intending to continue the ownership of his 20%. Then into the equation comes the EFL. And the EFL said part of the owners and directors test is that the key shareholders have to commit to finance and fund the club for the next 2 years. So therefore, Satori and Donald would therefore be included within that. And it looks as if they'd turn around and say, well, hold on, we thought that this new guy was the only person. And here we're entering what's referred to in a sort of partnership law as joint and several liability. Whereas if there are three or four of you involved in a business, if one of you fails to pay the bills, then the remaining partners effectively become responsible for them. So, let's say that if you, I, and producer Guy went out for a meal together and producer Guy forgot his wallet, the restaurant owner wouldn't say, Kieran and Kevin, you pay your share and I'll wait for Guy to pay me. It says, you came in as a group unit and therefore we expect the full amount of money. So that's where the problems start to arise because Sunderland have run out of their parachute payments. Mm. So therefore they're now in League One. They've got high overheads. They've got all the costs of running the club. And of course they've not got any of the benefits in terms of having, the significant numbers of fans, which they would normally anticipate, until we return to the government giving permission for fans to attend.
Mm. I can't imagine any circumstances by which producer guy would forget his wallet. It's huge. You're like forgetting a battleship. Where did I put that battleship? Oh, yeah, here it is. What the slightly worrying thing about that scenario, Kieran, is that phrase, bought his share for £1, because so many of the bad stories we've had in the past year have started with somebody buying some part of a club for £1, haven't they?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I'm not certain of that particular one, but I certainly have seen reports of that nature. He might have lent the club money. He might have introduced the club to other parties, and sometimes that you'll get a discount. But it's a strange one, and also, if I was taking over a football club, I'd want 100%. I wouldn't want two other blokes who'd be constantly signing. Well, you know, I'd have done it differently. You know, what are you signing in for? I wouldn't want the aggravation. And if this Kirill Louis-Dreyfus is as wealthy as he's claimed to be, then it should be relatively easy for him simply to buy the other two out at the outset, and then get on with the business of, you know, from his perspective and clearly from the fans' perspective, of restoring Sunderland, first of all, to the Championship, and then clearly their objective is to return to the Premier League.
Yeah, I also like the contempt in which you described young Mr. Dreyfus as an inheritance billionaire. I could feel your lip curling from a distance. And there are new details emerging of another takeover, Kieran. This is the takeover of Burnley.
Yes. The deal has gone through. It went through before Christmas, and I'm sure, or before the new year, and I'm sure people are sick to the back teeth of hearing me say Burnley, best-run club financially in the Premier League. The previous owners had never had to put a penny in. They always broke even or made a profit, never lived beyond their means. I felt that they were a textbook way, and you've got to give Sean Dyche a huge amount of credit for operating within the budget that he was dealt. But on, I think it was Monday night, a journalist from the New York Times, who's written a book on some of the unusual activities in football, he put out a very cryptic tweet saying that there's interesting talk about the owners of a newly acquired Premier League club scrabbling to raise £30 million by trying to sell an equity stake at a far higher valuation to repay the debt owed to the previous owner. And everybody's going, well, it's only one deal that's just gone through as far as the Premier League is concerned recently, and that's to do with Burnley. But he wouldn't go any further, and everybody sort of eyebrows raised. And then the following day in The Guardian, David Conn, who is a very good investigative journalist when it comes to football, and he certainly held FIFA to against the wall on occasions before through analysing some of their activities, he wrote an article to say that Burnley were £90 million worse off as a result of the takeover, because the new owners had agreed a deal for about £180 million, which they were paying in instalments, but it looks as if initially they've used £30 million of Burnley's own cash, because Burnley are a well-run club, as we've established, and therefore they've actually got cash in the bank. And then they had borrowed £60 million. And again, we have covered this before, at an interest rate of around about 10%, it would appear. So they're going to have to find £6 million in interest each year. And the fans were going, well, you know, initially, the new owners are talking a good game, and they certainly are. Just wait to the transfer window. And the transfer window came and went. Burnley didn't sign anyone. Now, the new owners, who are a company called AL Capital, they are convinced that they have the skills to take Burnley to be a successful club, despite all of these financial implications. And the reason why they think they can do that is because they're going to use artificial intelligence. They've got an app called AI Scout. And what happens is that if you think you've got the skills to be a footballer, you download this app, and then it gives you a number of drills. And based on you record this on your mobile phone, and on the basis of that, the artificial intelligence will determine whether or not they think you've got it to become a professional footballer. I feel slightly concerned here. There's an awful lot of people who think they know how to identify a footballer. Doing keepy uppies on a mobile phone is one thing. Doing it on a wet Tuesday in Stoke is another, as we've established on many an occasion. So there is certainly a risk element to what's happening in terms of the new owners. It could be that they've got a fantastic new system, and you know, I'm aware of the people who've developed the this artificial intelligence program. Part of me wonders if it is as good as it claims to be, why haven't Chelsea or Manchester United or Liverpool simply gone out and bought it themselves? You know, why has it ended up in the hands of a bunch of Wall Street guys who are now taking it to Burnley? So, you know, I wish them all the best. They've got to make it successful enough that the £6 million in interest is more than covered from the proceeds and the players who are identified from this app. If it doesn't work, then Sean Dyche's already small budget by Premier League standards becomes a bit smaller still.
That sentence, as you were explaining it, using artificial intelligence to identify new players, all sounded pleasingly futuristic until you said it's an app. It takes the edge off it a little. What is it? It's an app. What, a computer program? No, it's an app. You just download it. And you know, I don't know whether it's a new owner. Something is making Sean Dyche more skittish than usual. I don't know if you saw his press conference today, which most of which was taken up with people he's seen on his travels who look like other people.
Yeah, he's brilliant. I've told you, I love Sean Dyche. I think he's people don't get him, but there's far more to the man than the gravelly accent and the fact that he does resemble a centre half.
I defy anybody to hold his gaze for more than 5 seconds. Though, I mean, he's got the firmest handshake, and you just he knows whether you're lying. He's just got these terrifying. And it was another Burnley story as well. They're looking for a new shirt sponsor. Is that Burnley's decision, or have the shirt sponsor pulled out?
Well, this is a Burnley signed a 3-year deal with an Asian gambling company or betting company called Lovebet. Mm. Now, you know, it's one of those really strange arrangements for front of shirt, and I think, you know, lots of clubs have had them. I think, you know, Palace, you've probably had a couple of sponsors you think, well, I've never heard of them before, and they don't appear to have a website in the UK. But, you know, they're paying more than anybody else, so let's just take the money. And, you know, and you're probably not particularly bothered one way or the other. But there has been sort of more and more coming out about some of the activities relating to these betting companies. Betting is illegal in China. So why are companies having, yes, there is, European writing on them, but there's often Chinese, Mandarin, Cantonese descriptions on them as well. So, you know, is this a subliminal way of getting to the Chinese market, where, you know, there are gambling issues there? It doesn't appear to have much of a UK presence. So, you know, from the point of view, is it going to increase problem gambling in this country? The answer is probably not. I believe that they did pay quite a bit of money up front, but now it appears their Chinese website is no longer working. And I don't know whether they're still making the payments which are due to Burnley. But the reports that we are seeing is that Burnley is potentially now looking to change sponsors halfway through the season, which is unheard of. Mm. So, you know, that does suggest that Burnley are looking for a new partner. There's still another year to go, I think, in terms of the relationship with Lovebet. So one has to presume that that's not going to go ahead. We saw issues at the start of the season with Southampton, where their front of shirt sponsor disappeared. That was a gambling sponsor. Everton last season, they had an arrangement with an East African gambling company called Sport Pacer. That was linked to a lot of gambling problems and poor governance to do with issues back in Kenya. That deal was effectively cancelled, and now they've got a car dealership, an online car dealership as a replacement. So the dependency on gambling, I think, is starting to drop off. And clearly also there's increasing mutterings from government about coming to some form of restrictions in terms of the relationship with the gambling industry. But in terms of Burnley, given that if they are the club, and we don't know, that was mentioned in the New York Times, that is to quote, scrabbling to raise cash. You know, that's the last thing that they need if their front of shirt sponsor is behind in terms of the latest instalments due to them. Mm-hmm. So it's messy, and it's such a shame, because there are so many good things, and I'm, you know, we are both football romantics, and I think the story of Burnley and the achievements of Sean Dyche shouldn't be tarnished by things of this nature.
This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by designer sportswear brand Fugatti. Fugatti specialises in making bespoke, fully customisable football kits for teams at all levels, so you, your teammates and your fans can all look your sharpest on match days. With a huge range of colours and designs on offer, they've got something for every team, and it's all made to the highest quality without you needing to break the bank.
Yeah, and the company's also got plenty of football pedigree. The former Watford, Swansea and Sunderland striker Danny Graham's an investor, and it's run by one of the owners of Sittingbourne FC. They've also got their own brand of athleisure wear, which is a really groovy name, for both men and women, including tracksuits, jumpers, T-shirts and caps. So take a look at the website and follow them on Instagram to see their full range.
Although they probably don't do them in my size. But if you want your team to have a totally unique kit for next season, go to fugatti.co.uk and get 20% off their kits and clothing until the end of March 2021 using the code PRICEOFFOOTBALL. That's fugatti.co.uk using the code PRICEOFFOOTBALL. Yeah, you and Burnley need to get a room, Kieran. You know that, don't you? And as it happens, we'll be exploring all aspects of football's relationship with the betting industry quite soon when we speak to James Grimes from Gambling with Lives in a week or two. And if you have any questions for James specifically about betting and football, then email us the used address, which is questions@priceoffootball.com. Kieran, we still have a couple of stories to go. Let's see if we can rattle through them, because I'm worried about those new listeners from Leeds who don't know how to fast forward a pod. And sitting there drumming their fingers waiting for the interview, which is coming up. It is coming up, but let's do these last couple of stories. And a report has found that the £10.25 million loan from the council to Northampton Town, which we've talked about before in 2013 and 14, to use on stadium redevelopment, has, and I quote, serious failings.
Yes, there don't appear to be any minutes of meetings between people from the council and the borrowers. There appears to be little or no exploration of security. You know, if you're borrowing 10 million quid, then you know the first thing you do is you've got to show the wherewithal to repay it. And if you don't repay it, you know, what assets are you going to have to sacrifice? Well, it looks as if the Northampton Council failed in their duties there. The report by KPMG sort of didn't speak well, I think, in terms of the council leader, who apparently put pressure on the council to rush through this deal. That council leader subsequently became an MP, although he's no longer an MP. The council chief executive, he seemed very keen on the deal as well, but the report indicated that he exceeded his authority. He ended up resigning in 2017. But worst of all, you know, the local taxpayer has lost 10 million quid, and it would appear that public money has been lost, and there's at present little sight of it returning.
Mm. Well, we'll keep an eye on that one. How many stories do I promise to keep an eye on? We've got a huge list, haven't we? I imagine Guy's taking notes on his solid gold paper. We recently highlighted a positive story about Gillingham. This one, not so much. And it involved the Independent Football Ombudsman. And I have to admit, Kieran, I didn't even know there was an Independent Football Ombudsman. What does he or she do?
It's there to resolve disputes, right, between stakeholders, normally in the form of fans, but the clubs themselves. So to prevent the need to go through to a small claims court or things of this nature. You know, it's a mediation service. I must confess, I hadn't heard of it doing very much either. So you're not alone there. This is in respect of a Gillingham fan who'd been following the club, been a season ticket, been knocking around for over 20 years. And last season, you know, 2019-20, matches were unfulfilled. So he was waiting for smoke to come out of the club to say what's happening with return with respect to refunds. Nothing happened. So therefore, he wrote to the club, didn't get a reply that quickly. Eventually got a reply from the Gillingham owner, the I think he's Dubai resident Paul Scally, who said that he was too busy trying to save the club, and that true fans would acknowledge that and wouldn't be in a hurry to be asking for money back. I think it's then fair to say that the relationship between this fan and Mr. Scally deteriorated. I think the fan was saying that, you know, People on Twitter are saying that Paul Scally is using the club as a cash cow. I'm not convinced myself. There's evidence of that. And then the fan ended up getting banned for this season. Now, you know, it now transpires that the chances of getting to see many matches are few and far between. But even so, you know, is that ban going to go forwards to next season or not? So I think the fan was concerned. You know, the irony of ironies, because he was being banned for this season, the club therefore refunded his 2020-21 season ticket money. And the fan built up a 35-page dossier of communication between himself and various people at the club. And then it went off to the IFO, the Independent Football Ombudsman, whose recommendation was that, first of all, Gillingham give a clear statement with respect to refunds. And I'm astounded. You know, it's February 2021. Football stopped, realistically, in March 2020. If the club is still being vague as to its processes and actions in terms of a refund, doesn't reflect particularly well in respect of the club. And the IFO, and this is where it looks as if it's sort of a paper tiger. It's got no significant powers. It says that if individual fans are unhappy with the lack of progress, go to the small claims court. Yeah. Which, you know, surely if you're an independent ombudsman, you should have some form of being able to force clubs to comply with its recommendations. And this would indicate that it just seems to be there sort of as a placeholder as much as anything else.
From a PR point of view, it's very easily resolved this issue, as many clubs did, by saying, look, actually, we would rather not give refunds for this reason. But of course, if you feel that you want the money back, you can have it. And as we know, 80-90% of the fans would say, no, keep the money. It doesn't take a lot of doing, does it? And you allow these things to carry on and fester. And other fans instinctively will always take the part of the fan in here. So it's such a shame that only a couple of weeks ago we talked about that brilliant story about the school that Gillingham are funding, and then this tarnishes it a little. Now, we have one more news story before our interview with Parag Marate, and it's an American story, because Major League Soccer has issued a memo to its teams and league staff instructing them to prepare for a work stoppage.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Yes, this is sort of a classic. You know, you and I are both old enough to remember industrial disputes going back to the 70s and 80s. This is owners versus players. The owners are trying to force through concessions from the players, who have already agreed to pay cuts.
Yep.
The players are saying, well, we want something from this in return, in terms of perhaps some longer form of security. There is a collective bargaining agreement between the MLS and the union, which you know relates to all the terms. The players had agreed to halve their entitlement to media rights. So, you know, I think the union has, you know, given up a fair amount here, and there doesn't appear to be a lot of budge coming from the ownership side of things. The MLS season is due to start on the 3rd of April, and training commences on the 22nd of February. But the MLS is now getting quite aggressive and is sending out memos to say, well, you know, we're now thinking of going through the lockout route, which means the players won't get paid, which isn't going to help the sport. And if they do go down that particular route, I think this is pretty much pretty much of an own goal. The MLS is still fighting for space in terms of the attention of the armchair viewer in particular. So if it's not on TV, is it going to be missed hugely? The answer is probably no. We've got some of the other American franchise sports due to start their seasons relatively soon, and it could find itself squeezed out altogether. And given that it costs an MLS franchise owner up to $300 million for what's referred to as an introduction fee, and this is where if you want to bring the MLS to a new city, that's the amount you've got to pay into the central pot. I'm not sure of the logic behind the way that the MLS is negotiating on behalf of owners here.
Yeah, as somebody who used to be involved in industrial relations, I've firmly hold the maxim that any industrial action is always a failure of management, which wasn't a popular approach because I was part of management. But there you go. That is my view. And it's one of the reasons I became a comedian. And now an interview with Kieran with somebody from the US. Parag Marate is the president of 49ers Enterprises and now vice chair of Leeds United after they increased their investment in the club to 37%. We spoke to him about the future and the past of Leeds United. Parag, thank you so much for joining us. Apologies in advance if Kieran and I start bickering or finishing each other's sentences. We've been together on this pod a long time.
First of all,
just a general question to introduce yourself and what we're talking about today. Tell me the thinking behind that original acquisition of the 15% stake in Leeds United.
So let me completely rewind to 12 years ago. I did a tour in the UK and a little bit across Europe of looking at all of the football stadiums there as we were going through the process of designing and trying to design Levi's Stadium. I went across the pond to see if I could steal ideas for how stadiums were built, how they set up their supporters area, things like that. So I spent a week and a half, 2 weeks visiting almost every stadium in the Premier League. And came back with a big appreciation for European football and particularly English football. And so I started to do a little bit of homework in the early 2010, 2011 timeframe of clubs. And I just kept coming back to Leeds in terms of the club's history, the fan base, the global fan base, the great success they had had and how they had fallen on hard times since then. And in many ways, I saw it very similar to the 49ers from the early 2000s, where we had fallen on hard times. We, at the time, were playing at the oldest unrenovated stadium in the NFL. And you know, a team, the 49ers, enjoyed great success in the 80s and 90s and then struggled some. And we rebuilt and transformed the 49ers organization, starting with building Levi's Stadium, as well as, you know, as improving our on-pitch performance. And I just saw and revitalized a fan base, and I see saw strong similarities with Leeds. And so I actually struck a partnership, what we called a strategic partnership, two ownership groups prior to Andrea, and announced a deal publicly where we didn't invest any money, but we were going to just share business practices and we were going to lend some of our expertise. Fortunately for me, that deal never materialized because that was with an ownership group that didn't necessarily end up in the best way for Leeds. Mm-hmm. And so we each went on our way. And then Andrea and I met through a mutual friend in 14, 15, 16, sometime around then. I think it was 15 or 16. Nothing prior to him buying Leeds and us just we struck up a personal kinship and friendship. And he came out and visited. I spent the day with him, gave him a tour of Levi's, took him to dinner. And it was actually maybe a year after that or 6 months after that that he bought the club. Mm-hmm. And I reached out to him and said, hey, wait a second. This is a club that I'm interested in, too. And let's find a way to get together. And so then that's how the minority partnership started in 17, 18 with us, where it was just us dipping our toes in the water. I just knew that Leeds had great bones and a dormant fan base ready to explode. And so that's how it first started. And it's obviously materialized since then.
And very recently, you've increased that stake to 37%, which to a civilian like me seems a strange number. Is there a specific reason for that amount, or is it simply driven by how much you wanted to invest?
Yeah, no, it's just driven by amount invested and valuation. It was an arrival at a number, that's all.
Okay, and would it be impertinent to ask whether there may be further investment?
There could be, but like right now, we're just focused on the partnership. We're just focused. We're not even this 37%. It's not about how much money we're putting in. It's really about a deeper level of engagement. It's really about, and it's not just about me. It's about all of our people here at the 49ers. We've got a great team of executives, and us getting now more involved and, you know, sort of woven into the business operations and football operations at Leeds, and trying to help the club maintain success.
Now, I mean, you're playing some wonderful football at the moment. We're recording this after the game away at Leicester, which you've thoroughly deserved to win. I mean, you're a joy to watch, but Kieran and I are old enough to remember the Leeds side of the 1970s, which were an amazing football team, but had, shall we say, a robust physical approach, a bit like the Oakland Raiders. When you invested, were you aware of that history, or were you only interested in future potential?
Oh, both. Of course, aware of the history. Like that's the bones I'm talking about. We're talking about a club that, by virtue of that success 20 years ago and 40 years ago, we picked up fans in Australia, in Southeast Asia, in the Nordics, in North America. That's why we have a global fan base, because of that success. So, you know, it is why that we have that, plus the fact that we're a one club town and dominate our geography. Those are the main reasons why I believe Leeds has the potential to be one of the best clubs in all of Europe, and certainly in the Premier League.
It's really interesting you talk about that one club town, because there are other one club towns, Middlesbrough, for example, but somehow Leeds seem to encapsulate that. And there are other intangibles as well, like that, the beautiful all white kit, the history. There is something slightly different about Leeds United, and I think most football fans, I support Crystal Palace, Kieran supports a team I don't like to mention, but most football fans kind of want Leeds to be in the Premier League, because traditionally, historically, that's where they should be, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's a combination of a couple of things, though. Like, I know you mentioned Middlesbrough, but it's not just that we're a one-club town. It's that our town is a really big town, too. People don't realize that Leeds is, you know, given certain different metrics, whether you're talking about Yorkshire or Leeds, like we're the third or fourth largest metropolitan area in the UK. And so, you know, and that, and there isn't anybody above us that is a one club town, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why we have such enormous potential.
Levi Stadium, home of the 49ers, is, I mean, you can only describe it as a world-class multi-purpose venue. Could the same thing happen at Elland Road?
Yeah, certainly. But that's not the goal. The goal is to make it a best place to build ourselves a nice home field, home pitch advantage, and have it be a competitive advantage. Well, yes, we want to modernize the stadium. Yes, we want to make the experience better from a hospitality and premium standpoint. But we have to continue to capture the magic and aura that is within the 100-year grounds that is Elland Road. So it's really about – and there's a certain prestige and history there that we want to make sure we maintain.
I'd like to bring Kieran in here, because as an away fan, Kieran, I think you can confirm that Elland Road is a hair-raising place to visit, isn't it, for an away fan?
Very intimidating indeed. I mean, I can remember going back to watch my team play at Leeds in the early 1980s when Leeds was a very, very fierce town indeed. And you can see the players wilting just as much as the away fans used to. So if you're absolutely right, that if you can encapsulate that and improve the facilities and the infrastructure spend, which I think you've sort of hinted that some of the owners in recent times before Andrea came in weren't perhaps looking at Leeds' best long-term interests, I think you could be onto a winner there.
Yeah, that's the hope.
Yeah, Parag, you're more involved now as vice chairman in the day-to-day operations of the club. Is that limited to business matters only, or does it include football matters like player recruitment?
You know, I hope not. I hope it includes everything. If you guys, you can spend 30 seconds Googling me, and you'll know that I originally built my reputation in sports here at the 49ers with football things, such as negotiating all our player contracts and managing our contract structure and salary cap. And so that is my expertise. That's my wheelhouse. So will there be things that I can help with Leeds players, with the transfer market, with things like that? I certainly hope so. But again, I want to be able to support. I'm not a support Victor and Andrea and what they do on that side. I'm not, by no means do I want to govern it, but I do think that I'll be able to help.
Well, also support your remarkable manager who's, again, as a neutral, he's somebody you want to see. Marcelo Bielsa is somebody you want to see in the Premier League, isn't he?
Oh, he certainly is. He's one of those guys that has just tremendous willpower and is so creative and so focused on it. And like one of you guys said, just a style of play that is so entertaining and a style of play that in some ways has maybe been lacking in the Premier League recently, and we brought it right back.
Well, as a Crystal Palace fan, it most certainly is lacking at Selhurst Park. That's a different podcast. Let's not talk about that.
Well, we'll find out about that one on February 6th.
Yes. Oddly enough, the only game we played any decent football was against you earlier this season. But Parag, it often comes as a surprise to English sports fans to find that the NFL has a very creditable, democratic approach to the distribution of funds throughout the league. Were you surprised when you got involved in English football that equal distribution is very much not the case in the English Premier League?
I don't know if it was a surprise because I was aware of it, but how do I say this best? I wouldn't say it's not democratic because it is still absolutely meritocratic because it is still, you know, whether everyone has their share of the media rights in the Premier League, but based on where you finish in the table, you get a larger chunk of the pie. And how many times you're on, you're picked by Sky or BBC to be the primetime match, you earn more for that. And the way you get there is by being a better team, right? Better team, you matriculate up the table. Better team, you're on primetime more often. And if you get those things, then you do get a bigger share of the pie. So that is in many ways democratic, as well as the promotion relegation. Now, what I'll say is it certainly adds an extra element of suspense and drama and heart rate that goes along with it. But, you know, it's part of the excitement of the Premier League, and it's why it's maybe the most exciting league in the world.
Now, when you and the 49ers got involved with Leeds, did you set yourself targets as to where Leeds should be in 2 years, 3 years, 5 years time? And are you ahead of those targets now?
You know, we follow Andrea's vision and leadership, and Andrea's set himself, set some lofty aspirations and goals for the club. One of which was getting promoted within 5 years, and he definitely achieved that early on an earlier time frame to get that in 3 years. And so I think right now it's sure you could look ahead and say, yes, we want to compete in Europe and Europa and compete in the Champions League. Do we have the ability to? Yes, we should be dreaming like that. But right now, incrementally, it's just about showing that we can be sustainably competitive in the Premier League, that we're not just hanging on by the laces of our boots, that we belong. And, you know, if we're a club that we don't enter any season thinking about, is this a year that we could get relegated, then that's a good positive step.
And Andrea, as you talked about, the majority owner of Leeds, he's talked about deepening ties with clubs around Europe. Is that a process that's already started?
Yeah, I mean, it's just something that he's always fancied and looking at. It's not something right now. My focus and our focus is on helping Leeds become more successful.
Yeah, there's been, if we talk about Europe, there's been a lot of discussion recently, Parag, about a semi-closed European Super League and possibly a reduction in the size of the Premier League. What does an ambitious club like Leeds make of those proposals?
You know, I don't know the details of those proposals. So right now for me, it's hypothetical or it's secondhand based on what I read in media outlets and articles. So I can't speak too much for it, but I can say I do like the meritocracy that they have in the Premier League. I do think it's set up well for if a club is successful and good, they get to move up the table and earn more and earn more opportunities to compete in European competitions. And I think the current setup is good. I like it. And so I don't hope it changes.
If I could bring Kieran in here again, Parag, because he moans, but technically both of us work on his podcast and he moans if I don't include him. But Kieran, you've always talked about, you've been a fan of Leeds as a well-run club, a potentially massive club in English Premier League and in Europe. What do you think the potential Super League, how would that affect Leeds?
My concern for a club such as Leeds, and I think you can also include other clubs such as Aston Villa, Leicester, Wolverhampton Wanderers, Newcastle, if they had a new ownership structure, is that trapdoor could be closed, which I think would be scandalous, because to see a variety of clubs in Europe, I think is fantastic. And for too many years in recent times, it has very much been a closed shop as to who can access it. So my concerns is that if the proposals for, say, 15 out of 20 teams are picked on invitation only, and therefore there's five clubs in the whole of Europe scrabbling over trying to get into the remaining places in what, some form of Champions League, that would be a backward step. And also, I think if I was a Leeds fan, for Leeds fans, the biggest matches of the season, Manchester United, Liverpool and so on, and to go from having 38 games a season in the Premier League to 34, if I'm a local fan in Leeds, I think I'd be fairly disappointed with that.
Well said, Kieran.
Yeah, Parag, there's two more questions I'd like to ask you about Leeds, and they're both sort of fan based. And then I want to move on to a completely different sport, if you don't mind. The first question is, and I think Leeds fans would like me to ask you this. At the moment, everything in the garden is rosy for Leeds. You've got a fantastic manager. I think you finished the game yesterday with 11 players that got you out of the Championship and into the Premier League, which is a remarkable achievement. You've got money to spend. If, God forbid, in the next season or two, Leeds were not to have it as much as it, maybe they went back into the Championship, would you still be as committed? Would the investment from the 49ers still be there?
Oh, yeah. This is not about being front runners because we're enjoying being in the Premier League. This is about a commitment to keep Leeds and Leeds on the right path to success and continue to grow and develop. If we have blips on the radar or obstacles, we'll get through them together. But this is not, by no means are we bandwagon front runners. We're in this for the long haul.
That's a bandwagon front runners is another phrase I'm going to take away from this. Your management team, Parag, in the States is famed for an innovative approach to business and sport. Do you think English football fans are quite as open to change as American ones are? Because we can be quite anxious about new things, English football fans.
Yeah, you know, I mean, innovation is not always just about change. It's just about improving what you already have. And so, like I said, Leeds has great bones. We're just trying to harness what the potential is here. And help it grow. And, you know, I think the one big difference is this is not just an economic play for us. This is not just some detached, dispassionate investment. We're all in. We are riding the waves of emotion. You know, it's 6 o'clock in the morning and I'm waking up my kids because I'm screaming when they first scored the first goal yesterday. you know, it's this, this is about passion as much as it is about investment. And so hopefully that differentiates us from some other examples of American ownership in Europe.
It's such a shame, isn't it, Parag, that Leeds United and their brilliant fans have waited so long to get back in the Premier League and they can't get back into Elland Road. That's so frustrating, isn't it?
Yeah, it's too bad. I hope to be there that first time that we're able to get back in Elland Road because it's a special place.
Now, in the short time that we've known each other, Parag, it's clear that you're an upbeat, energetic sort of chap. And also, you must be very optimistic because you're chairman of USA Cricket, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. And you plan to establish cricket as a US sport by 2030. Kieran and I are huge cricket fans. We both love cricket. I'm a big Surrey fan. He's a big Sussex fan. But even we think that target may be a little bit optimistic, is it?
So what I'll say there is I can just bring it back to one sentence and then it's on us to deliver it. That sentence is that we're talking about the second biggest sport in the world.
Yeah.
And we in the US are the largest media market in the world. So you've talking about the second largest sport in the world, having an opportunity to be successful in the largest media market in the world. It doesn't matter what sport, it could be widget ball. It doesn't matter what sport it is. That just smells of opportunity, right? Now it's on us to deliver on that. And obviously financial resources and means do enable you to do more and actually then enables athletes to either come here and play in the U.S. or enables the dream for young athletes here already domestically to realize that there is an opportunity for them. And in time, we can develop the sport here. And you know, we do think that we can become one of the 12 full member nations. And we do think we can be competing at the highest levels in 9 years. I think if we're able to get Major League Cricket, which is the name of our domestic T20 league that will start here next year, if we're able to get that off the ground, that gives us an 8-year runway to build a foundation of success. I don't think it's a stretch by any means. If we're talking about the 10th most popular sport and the 20th largest media market, then maybe you're right. But we're the largest media market in the world. We have the resources to be successful. It's on us to now deliver that.
And that tournament you're starting next year, that's an IPL-style tournament, presumably, is it?
Yep, that's right.
Well, that's really exciting. I mean, Kieran already travels all over the world doing all sorts of things, including watching cricket. But it would be lovely to know that America is a place we could go and watch cricket as well. One more question, Parag, and thank you so much for joining us. Are you – well, I think I know the answer to this, but are you enjoying the journey so far in English football?
I'm loving it. I'm loving it and I'm hating it because my blood pressure. My wife doesn't like the fact that, you know, it used to only be 16 games, 49er games that I live and die by. And now I picked up 38 more. I'm in all seriousness, I absolutely love it. And I watch every second of every match.
I'm glad that you said you're loving it and hating it because that's a proper English football fan's response.
Yeah.
Loving it first, then you think about it and say hating it. It's strong. I love, again, Kieran, I love all sports, but I mean, NFL is something that I watch all the time. And I think, again, English sports fans will be surprised by the comparison. There are NFL fans who are like English football fans, aren't they? I mean, every stadium has its pound with its passionate fans, don't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everyone, every place does, and there's tremendous passion. But I'll tell you, there's something special in the UK. Like I said, when I first visited and did my tour of stadiums in 2009, 2010, there's an extra layer of magic there because I think that people feel that the club is theirs, as they should, and they feel like it's part of their family, like a little brother or a little sister where you're so proud of its success and you're very protective when they fail. You want to protect them. And that is an extra layer of emotion and passion and love and hate for a club that is not, I don't really think that's manifested here as much as it is in the UK.
Mm. Parag, thank you very much for talking to us. I know Leeds United fans were very excited when we mentioned that we were going to be talking to you. And I don't think any of them will be disappointed by what they've heard. So thank you. Good luck for the rest of the season. Nice to talk
to you. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you very much. Kieran, he's obviously a very positive and dynamic force. I wouldn't be surprised to learn that he was running on a treadmill while he was talking to us. He was brilliant, but he certainly seems to get Leeds United, doesn't he?
Yes, because it looks as if he's done his homework many years ago. And the initial relationship between the 49ers and the club was on a more platonic level, but now they certainly see the opportunities to grow the club. And I think if they can use their expertise and their knowledge, it can only be a positive thing for the club and the fans.
Mm. And would your instinct be that he sounds like somebody who is looking to extend that investment even further?
I think that there's going to be some big decisions made in respect of Leeds at some point. They are selling out Elland Road at present. There's 20,000 people on a waiting list to become season ticket holders. Now, post pandemic, and I think we need to wait for the waters to settle. When ideally the vaccination has proven to be successful, then a decision has to be made with where are we going to go in terms of the facilities. I think it was really encouraging that he says that he wants to retain that atmosphere of passion and fear that the Elland Road can generate. And I'll be honest, the scariest football experience in a ground I've ever had was at Elland Road when our striker Michael Robinson scored in the 1981-82 season to put us 1-0 up, Leeds' last home game of the season, and we were potentially going to send them down. I was so relieved when they scored a 93rd minute winner, which is a terrible thing to say, but I valued my life over 3 points in those days. There's lots of very positive things about Leeds and Elland Road. When that decision has to be made, are they going to be looking for external investment, or are San Francisco 49ers then going to say, right, we now want to take control? I was reading a very interesting article with regards to the NFL. And I think if you take the last 7 or 8 NFL Super Bowl matches, in 90% of them, there has been a club owner of the NFL who was also an owner of a football club. So could it be SF 49ers say, well, there's clearly something going on here. Perhaps we want to be part of that gang, and therefore in due course, we might want to increase our stake so that we become the majority owners, and therefore Parag's involvement at present, which is part of the management team, is sort of upgraded to be he then becomes the senior decision maker. Now clearly Andrea Radrizzani is that person at present, and they clearly have a very good relationship, so I don't see any problems at present.
And I'm glad as well, you get the impression that Parag clearly knows about the past of Leeds United, but I wonder if he fully realises quite what a strange, brilliant, superstitious man Don Revie was. There's a Yorkshire TV documentary that you can Google. There's footage of him massaging Jack Charlton, which once you see it, you can never unsee it, basically. And the players weren't allowed to have sex on a Friday night, so he made them stay in a hotel and play bingo. And there's some great shots of people like Alan Clark, who's very surly about the fact they're having to play bingo rather than be at home. But he was an amazing man. And I think younger football fans probably don't realise what a giant Leeds United were in the late 60s and through the early 70s, when they probably didn't quite win as much as they should have done. But they were up there with Liverpool as giants of the game, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and they were seen as being very innovative. Things such as the relationship with Admiral and the development of kits which you could buy in the shops and away kits. They were a few years ahead of other clubs at the time.
Yeah, and they had the sock tags and the smiley badge, and the players used to go out in the middle of the pitch and wave to all four corners of the ground and kick balls into the thing. So they were very, very good at PR, the sort of stuff you ironically would associate with NFL. So, yes, we'd like to thank Leeds United and Parag for talking to us. And thank you for Leeds fans' patience. And let's hope some of them carry on listening. And if they have any questions for us for our next pod, we do 2 a week. One's a news one on Thursday and one's a questions one on Monday. Then get in touch with us with questions at priceoffootball.com. Kieran, I can relax and watch tonight's games after 2 wins in a row for Palace, Kieran. Who would have thought? Just did a very giddy Palace podcast off the back of it. Tricky game for you tonight, though, of course. You'll be watching from behind the sofa.
Away at Liverpool. I'll settle for a point now. I'm not a greedy man, as you know.
Settle for a point. I'd settle for losing 4-0. Talk to Mr. Yeah, I'll settle for a point. Kieran, we'll say goodbye, and we'll leave you to do so in your own unique way.
Okay, well, thanks to Kevin, thanks to Parag, and if you've enjoyed the show, if you can press on the on that purple icon on your Apple phone app, or if you're using Android, Google apps or whatever, if you're enjoying the show, it'd be great if you could give us a 5-star review. We don't understand why it works. If you just say something, you can say, you know, when are they going to get the Swiss ramble? When are they going to get rid of the smart? It doesn't matter what you say, but according to our leader, it makes a difference in terms of the charts, and therefore it allows us to have a bit of credibility when we timidly contact people such as the 49ers, saying we're two old blokes from South London, fancy having a chat with us. So until then, stay safe.
Yeah, and you can say what you like. The smart stays.
The price of football. The price of football.